a poem by the Sufi master Hafiz. Why are there so few in the court of a perfect saint? Because every time you are near him, you have to leave pieces of your ego with the hatchet girl who won't give them back. Why are there so few in the court of a perfect saint? Because every time you are near him, you have to leave pieces of your ego with the hatchet girl who won't give them back. Ouch. Tonight's talk is the second in a series on the third noble truth, entitled Liberation from Self-Belief and Self-Referencing. Now, none of these talks stand by themselves. They're all a part of the umbrella of the Four Noble Truths. So you need to have understood the first two of the Four Noble Truths in order for the third noble truth to make sense as to what we're liberating ourselves from. What is liberation? Liberation is from the anguish, the self-imposed anguish, the self-imposed dissatisfaction and unsatisfactoriness that consists and persists in our life. And unless we get a sense of how that originates, then to even speak about freedom really doesn't make any sense, doesn't have any context. So this sense of self-referencing, or the third noble truth, is intimately tied with the first two truths. So let us, each time we get homework or prepare to come to the classes, rehearse what the first two truths are so that we are set and prepared with right orientation, so that we can understand what liberation means. Liberation doesn't exist except in relationship to the problem that is exposed in the first and second noble truths. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time going back over those. The expectation is that you are now pretty cemented in that. And from time to time, I will review it a little bit. But we're up and running here. And so I think a mistake that many people make is they kind of select out what's readable to them in the Buddhist literature. And you can't really, everything is tied together in unison. In fact, that's what the teaching is about, the unison, seen in union. And the teaching itself is not something that you select out piece by piece. It's a totality. So one thing that I think becomes increasingly obvious when we begin to talk about this third noble truth is that at a certain depth, the Buddhist teaching begins to make us uncomfortable. It begins to disturb our lifestyle. And if it doesn't, then we're missing something. It's not status quo. It's not just living day to day with minor corrective behavior. It should deeply disturb us in some way. And I don't mean disturbing us in terms of us not believing it or feeling that it's false teaching, but that it takes us to the core of our orientation and says, look again, we better look at that, how we're orienting, the posture we have to life. And I don't think there's anything more threatening to us than this truth that of what we are and what we are not. Because if you look at the premise on which this culture and perhaps all cultures are formed, it's with the assurance that your existence is a given. and that you have a separate, you are a separate entity from. And all of our culture and all of the laws therein and all of the governance and all of the views we hold are based upon that single premise. Now, if you examine that premise and it proves to be false, which is where the Buddha's teaching takes us, what happens to that which has been built up from that premise? Obviously, it falls flat. And so that's the reshuffling. It's like, my God, everything has to be re-examined here. Everything has to be re-understood in orientation to this new understanding as it begins to dawn on us. It's the hardest aspect of the teaching for it to dawn on us. It's not a given that even after however many years you've been practicing, you have a sense that of the truth of anatta. But what you might have is a growing flavor that something is amiss when I only come from this embodied sense of my being, from this sense of me and everything else being outside of me. That it doesn't fit somehow. It doesn't work very well. That's obvious in terms of the state of affairs of the world. But it's also obvious in terms of the states of affairs of ourselves. That something is a little off. And as we sit in meditation and begin to look at the range and proliferation of mind, we begin to see that there really isn't any place that my attention goes that doesn't that lasts very long, that feels solid or feels permanent. And that can create a growing unsettledness in the fact, in a worry perhaps, that there may not be anything in there. And lo and behold, at some point in the meditation, the conclusion is reached that that is in fact the truth of our mind and body. Now, many people live with that intellectual understanding, but the problem is that the intellectual understanding is the embodiment of the absence of that truth. So you can rehearse it all you wish and memorize it and believe it all you want, and you're actually working adharmically with yourself, against the Dharma. So this sense of minor disturbance, and sometimes it comes, I've had people talk to me often, where the awareness is seeing something, then there is a sense of awareness seeing itself, aware of the awareness of where the awareness was in a position, the positionality of the awareness, and then a worry or a fear comes up, like, if I'm not there, where am I? And that is the first, I think, or one of the first inroads that attention, paying attention to ourselves, has upon that sense of basic life disturbance. Basic life disturbance. Now, we can handle much of the teaching without being very disturbed at all. I mean, if I say, okay, anicca, everything changes. You go, okay, great, that's all right. I can handle that one. It means I don't have to get so concerned with whatever mood I might be in or with whatever entrapment or situation or stress, that if I am patient with myself, then it'll move along. It brings a kind of softness of understanding about oneself and a kind of tolerance and a willingness to partake in oneself without too much of a jolt. It allows a kind of relaxation and a general sense of acceptance. However, acceptance of self is very different in terms of its disturbance than what the Buddha is pointing to. For the Buddha, in one sutta, the Bahiya Sutta, I think it's pronounced, he says it this way. There was a man who was in desperate need of the essence of his teaching and traveled a great distance and came up to the Buddha while he was on alms round. And he asked the teacher, the Buddha, he says, what's the essence of your practice? And the Buddha said, not now, I'm on alms round. And the guy persists and says, but I need to know, or something to that effect. And the Buddha said, in the seeing, there is just what is seen. In the hearing, there is just what is heard. In the cognizing, there is just what is cognized. And he went through each of the senses that way. And then, as the story goes, when the man heard that, he was enlightened, and then moments later he was gored by a bull or something and died. That's the way those things go. I'm waiting for this wayward bull to pass along here somewhere so that I can give you the essence of the teaching. But it just doesn't work. But in any case, you listen to that, and in the seeing there is just what is seen. In the seeing there is just what is seen. You see, what the Buddha seems to be saying to me is that there's nothing other than this. That acceptance is fine, but it's kind of a moderation. It's an incremental change. And the Buddha says, cut all that stuff. There's nothing other than this. There is just what is seen. There is just what is heard. There's nothing else. There's no dimensionality in this. There's no there's no listening, figuring it out, and then applying some alteration. He really cuts to the chase. And I think that it holds the key to what the Third Noble Truth is trying to say here. That thought creates the idea that there is more to life than just what is seen, just what is heard. But that perception has no alternative. It's not as if you could have another thought besides the one you're thinking. Though you think you can. And that's where the alternative comes from. But this moment expresses itself in completion just as it is, as seen. That's in its totality. That's it. The arising of it. And there is no possibility of it in any other way. Now, I had a doctor friend who was our medical director at a hospice that I was on staff back about 20 years ago. And he was a physician who went out and made home visits to people who were dying. And he said one time he went out and he was visiting a patient. And the patient was lying on the couch, and he had the patient sit up and was listening to the patient's heart or lung or something with a stethoscope and looking into the patient's eyes at exactly the moment that the patient died. So the patient was sitting up and he was listening to the lungs, looking into the patient's eyes at exactly the moment the patient dies. And he said that he was drawn in to where the patient was, to what the patient was, and to what death was. And he said it was as close as he knew he could ever come before having to die himself. And he came back quite shaken, quite disturbed, because he realized, having seen it, that there was just a vacuum, that the patient held no sense of being other than emptiness. And he was drawn into that emptiness, and the emptiness then became a statement of the patient's death as well. And I think he saw in that moment, although he didn't speak about it in this way, that that's all there ever was. That that's the only thing that ever was. And that it was just the thought that gave the embodied person any form or any dimensionality. I see it actually in animals, as I mentioned last talk. And I've since then been looking at our cat. And our cat, because we've had it now for 5 years, it has a history with it. You know, it can be the cat that scratches up our rugs, and the cat that, you know, does different things that I don't like around the house, or the cat that I like, the cat that's affectionate. But every once in a while, the cat will look into my eyes, and I won't see anything there. There's nothing there. It doesn't have any dimensionality. But it's a perfect cat in that vacuity. Isn't that interesting? Because where does the perfect cat come from? You see? It arises in the perfection of the moment. It doesn't arise meaning that it has a history in which it arises. I mean it arises in immediacy, spontaneously. Not from having all of its cat history, but from nothing, moment after moment. And so part of how we handle the disturbance of the truth of that is that we kind of slowly adjust ourselves in our practice to a growing willingness to accommodate parts of ourselves that we have taken to be so three-dimensional as being really not such a bad, not such a bad arising, like emotions. Emotions may occur, and the first time they occur, they throw us back because they represent everything that we don't like about ourselves, our anger and all of the history associated with it. But as we relax more and more to the different aspects of mind, as we relax and don't judge ourselves, as we release the contraction we have around different components of our mind's experience, each thing really doesn't mean much of anything, does it? It certainly doesn't mean anything about who you are. It may imply a history, but in the moment it's arising, it doesn't carry that history. It's just an arising. It's just this happening. Only this. Only this. In the seeing, there is just what is seen. And the cognizing, there is just what is cognized. And the less we move in avoidance or in desire of whatever is arising, the less we invest that dimensionality of our own identification in with it, and the more it's seen in its vapor-like quality, almost ghost-like, like looking into the cat without the history of the cat. And just seeing it as a seeing rather than as the story of what I see. You see, because if this is it, then there is nothing to accept, is there? What does acceptance have to do with it? That's trying to make this be just it. But when it is just it, which it always is, then what is the acceptance? That doesn't have anything to do with anything. And when we start looking at how thought encourages a kind of restlessness in us, a kind of need to pursue and to embody in time everything that has meaning and everything that is worth. And we begin to see how thought moves outside of this, just this, just this. How it is the only thing that can move outside of just this. But if you also look at it, it's also just a complete and perfect manifestation of just this. Because where is it moving? It's just a thought happening now. It's not really pointing anywhere. Is it? A thought is occurring now. It's not occurring in the time frame of the thought. It's like the thought about my childhood is happening now. And it's possible to see thought as arising now, as the cognized. In the cognized, there's only what is cognized. But because we can't usually see thought in terms of it arising now, we think of it as pulling us somewhere else, taking us into some other dimension of time. And therefore we attach a whole significance to our thinking that isn't justified by the Third Noble Truth. In fact, the justification we give our thinking is the problem of our anguish and pain. Because once we release thought to be and hold time, past and future, then it'll take us anywhere. It will take us anywhere. It'll take us to the tragedies of our memory, where we have to relive them. It'll take us to the dreams of our future, which we hope to live. And our life then becomes a kind of hope and wish fulfillment, and a regret, and a despair. Because thought is not seen for what it is. It's interesting. I was reading, one of you gave me this article, and it's about finding happiness in the pursuit. So I just want to read a little bit of it. It becomes obvious where this is going. And one of the great puzzles of human nature, is why humans strive for more material things, money, job, homes, cars, flat screen TVs, when it doesn't seem to make them any happier in the long run. Philosophers have pondered this conundrum for centuries, and modern economists have been examining it over several decades. Not only does greater wealth not guarantee happiness, even when you get what you want, research indicates that you will not find it as satisfying as you had hoped, and you'll want something else. Stay with me here. This is not just about that. Claudia Sinek, professor of economics at the Sorbonne, believes that the struggle for a certain achievement may offer a particular reward all its own. Although many people seem quite goal-oriented, especially when it comes to money and homes and other goods, maybe it's not so much having the stuff that people really enjoy, but the struggle to obtain it. We all have experienced the phenomena, behavioralists call it adaptation, whereby once you attain whatever you most covet, it quickly loses its luster. Dr. Sinek's research suggests it is fine to crave the condos and the cars as long as you realize that there may be more pleasure in striving for those goals than in actually achieving them. Dr. Sinek offers a more positive view. You can let go of the reality of getting something, but don't let go of the struggle to improve, to progress, to achieve, and to be ambitious, because that's where your happiness lies. Now, that's very interesting to me. In some ways, it's not very deep, but it at least shows that the material gains that we acquire, when we rest with them, don't really provide any happiness. What gives us happiness, according to this research, is the idea of its gain, is the sense that what it will be like once I do have it, is the hope that it gives me for what my life will be when I obtain it. Once it's obtained, however, it loses its value. Why does it lose its value? Because ultimately, when you sit with it and you are no longer moving towards it, it comes back to its regular emptiness. It's only when I move towards something that I embellish it to be more than it is. But when I rest with it, having obtained it, and therefore I'm no longer pursuing an ideal of it, it just comes back to being what it is, which for a while is quite nice, but then as you live with it for a little while, it loses its luster, it loses its valence, and it becomes just that. And no longer is there happiness in just that. Happiness in the pursuit is in the pursuit. And we begin to see that that's what the strategy of thought does. The strategy of thought embodies me in my pursuit. It gives me a sense of strategy about life. It gives me some ideal, some hope, some meaning that will come my way. And when that meaning is lived, and when you have obtained your goals, you have to strive further in order to regain the momentum of that reward system. See, I think that is beginning to reflect the true emptiness of things. Because if things had value of and for themselves, then acquiring them would give you that value. But when you have that thing and they no longer give you value, it must mean that they never held it in the first place. And therefore, why pursue them? And therefore, why pursue anything? We pursue it in order to keep ourselves alive in the only way we know ourselves to be alive, and that is in time. Reaching not for what is here, not for just this in the seeing there is just what is seen, but in the seeing there is hope for what will be. In the hearing there is an expectation of what will come. And that idea, setting our ideas, our thoughts loose in that kind of dimension, thereby nourishes us to keep going, to keep moving, to keep looking ahead of where we actually are. I see this in the dying, when people are dying, and because when people were dying, they, for the most part, had lost their ability to reference the future, because the future was being taken away from them. So they couldn't expect to obtain, their ambition was dwindling, they weren't striving. What were they striving for? So it was beginning, time was beginning to implode on them, where they couldn't keep moving out, thinking about the better moment that is yet to occur, rather than to live and embody the moment that was occurring. And when that crunch came to some people, what would often happen is that they would go back in time. Okay, if there's nothing in the future, then there must be some meaning for me in the back. And they would come with life review and all the regrets, so that they would find their dimensionality and what they had been, rather than where they were going. And a few people wouldn't move backward or forward. And you could feel, a very few people, you could feel some sense of opening, some sense of change of quality in them. And when you entered and spoke with them, what mattered to them was often matters of the heart, matters of connection and contact and caring. I remember one woman who was on the edge of her death. And I saw this kind of transformation, because at that point in hospice care, we had patients for several months. And when I first met her, she was very well and could think in the future and plan and hope that she wouldn't die. And then as her illness progressed, she lost that hope. And with it, she lost a whole projection into the future, to the point that at one point, she went and fell into a kind of despair. And then the next time I met her, she had come out of that despair. And she was totally, our meeting, in the last meeting I remember, had everything to do with me, nothing about her. She asked me how I was, how my life was I dating anybody at that point. She was, and she, I had, I don't know, some kind of, I don't remember, but a sprained wrist or something, and she was very concerned. There was no sense of being entrapped in her condition any longer. And her heart had come out, and she was interested in me. What was the problem with me? There she was dying. I was the healthy one. And she was only interested in that. You see now what traps our heart, don't you? You see how we get lost when our thoughts continue to extend ourselves through referencing ourselves into some abstraction. And then our whole sense of life comes around that tunnel of abstraction of the future and what the future will mean to me and what I'm going to obtain in it. And that sense of, it's that sense of reaching beyond oneself into an abstract time where I can continue to perpetuate myself. And you can see why in that enclosed space of one's own self-concern, there can't be any true affection that comes out of that tube, out of that tunnel. It's interesting because, you know, the story of grief is really the story of losing a particular focus on one's reference. Something outside. Referencing, by the way, is what I mean is that thought invests in a particular desire and it won't let that desire go. And but then when the desire does go, like in death or missed opportunity or circumstance, then there's a sense of self-despair that comes. First there's denial, because what happens when you lose something important to you in terms of your self-referencing is it has an impact on our own image. Life is given its value whereby we are also given our value through the value we give life. And when life is lost, that referencing is lost, and we kind of implode on ourselves. It's a tremendous opportunity to see what we have been dependent upon for our sense of self-image, the sense of me. But instead, what we do is we go back and we become self-pitying. And we think, oh, poor, I'll never have another girlfriend like the one that just left me. We make the situation not one of wisdom, but one of further story. And the story of grief really is the story of how I can live without the referencing dependency that I've had with this person. Rather than seeing who one is, what one is, when they don't have that dependent relationship anymore. Because that's a very different way of understanding how the mind can only exist in terms of its own dependency. That it needs to lean in order to survive. And when something that it leans upon is pulled away, it falls. In fact, if you want a tangible relationship, take the thing that means the most to you and make it like a pillar. Just have something like a wall and say, okay, this is my wife. And now lean against it so that if it was pulled out, you would fall. And get a sense of the somatic relationship between the wall, which is your wife, or your whatever it is that's most meaningful to you, and how you're standing. And you just keep feeling the leaning effect and place the object of your leaning at the other end of that. And you get a sense of it. What would happen if the wall died? What would happen to me? I think that once you become, you start embodying your relationship to some of this referencing that we do, some of this dependency that we have, you begin to see that the world is very, very precariously perched here. because all relationships are going to end. All referencing is going to end. And we had better start looking at that. And what is it that the first expression of mind does when it senses that that relationship may be altered is that it denies it. It refuses to acknowledge it. It says, this isn't happening to me, and this isn't happening to her. This will continue, this relationship will continue. You can see the need to be alive comes from that relationship. I need to be alive through her, through him. And then when it becomes known that this person is going to die, the anger that arises from having something, your aliveness threatened. Your aliveness threatened. And the blame and the accusation and the fault and the doctor didn't and why didn't I and all self-blame, other blame. And then that moves into a kind of precariousness in which we are sort of trying to bargain our way out of it. Look, you know, I haven't been the best person, but I'll be a better person in the future if I can just get around this one obstacle. And how we still invite a kind of projection into the future to handle this particular situation and say, I'll improve. I will be a better person. I will do everything. I'll go to church. And then the despair that comes when that doesn't change the outcome. And all of it, why? Because we have invested in referencing outside of ourselves, or invested in referencing ourselves into something like our body. What about when our body goes? Or invested in referencing our identification in our emotion. Or in our thinking. Wherever we rest our identification, that embodiment, that referencing, will eventually change into something else. And therefore, where our stability on this earth through referencing is always troublesome, very disturbing, which is what the Buddha's teaching, why the Buddha's teaching disturbs us, because all he's done and does is point to where we continually become dependent. So you better watch that. Oh, I can't. Oh. Not that. Don't take that away from me. So what is reality without referencing? What is reality without referencing? What is reality? You see, the Buddha said what reality was like. In the seeing, there is just what is seen. It's so hard. I understand how difficult it is for us to get a sense that this moment is not a continuous one. It doesn't connect with anything. It's arising spontaneously on its own. It has no connection with anything. That's really what we're saying when we say in the seeing there is just what is seen. And in the willingness not to have it be a continuum, fullness comes. Richness. In other words, ultimately, what we have to do is divorce ourselves from time. We have to see that thought, which constantly tries to think of its past and the future it needs to have, is really operating in a dimension of false reality. And the sense of me that seems to depend upon the future for my happiness and the obtaining of certain things or the struggle to get really is the false form of happiness. It's the happiness of a false sense of self. And that in the moment, there is joy, which is not dependent upon whatever might be arising and accompanying in the moment, because all the things that arise in the moment accompany the moment. My confusion, my anger, my whatever, even the sense of me. Now what are we going to do? You see, when we understand, I know that I'm going out there tonight. Just let me go out there, okay? Because I can feel the pull on some of you. Some of you, just go out, let's go. Why not go? Because it's disturbing? You see, I know what I'm doing is that I'm pulling up the stakes of all the things that mean something to you. All the reasons you have for living. But if those reasons aren't based upon the truth, if they're based upon the false pretense of someone needing someone, of the referencing I constantly give the world that doesn't hold in reality that truth at all, then what's our life been about? And what will our death be about when we have to face that fact? The third noble truth is not for everybody. It's a very strong medicine. But do you want me to give it to you halfway? Do you want me to give you just as much as you can handle, which would be accept yourself, be kind to yourself, love yourself? That's a half measure. Or do you want me to pull the self up from its very roots and to know the truth, come what may? That's the question. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? As we sit, I'd like to read something by Shanti Deva. Shanti Deva was, I think, a 7th century Indian Buddhist philosopher. And he said, when neither something nor nothing remains to be known, there is no alternative left but complete non-referential ease. When neither something nor nothing remains to be known, there is no alternative but complete non-referential ease. In the seeing, there is just what is seen. Okay, so if people have anything they'd like to ask or question, I'd be happy to take whatever time we have to do that. And don't feel, yes.
I wasn't sure I heard you right when you said this, but did you say that thinking about the fact that you are empty of the self, that thinking about it is harmful or going in the opposite direction of the
The question is, in thinking about the truth, is that harmful or going in the opposite direction? I wouldn't say it was harmful, but it's going in the opposite direction. Yes. Because, I mean, it doesn't imply the fact that reflection doesn't have a way to, doesn't have a value. But you aren't going to be able to find emptiness from thinking about emptiness. That's what I really meant. So you can't think about anatta, non-self, and expect that thought to come into the experience of what it means to see it in truth, to see the fact of it. The fact of it is the only thing that will change you, not the philosophy of it. In fact, it's a terrible philosophy. Why is it a terrible philosophy? Because if you don't exist and I don't exist, I can do anything I want to you. It gives me free permission to do virtually anything without any rules or ethical behavior at all. But the embodiment of emptiness, the embodiment of non-referential ease, is the full embodiment of the heart. And the heart will govern itself according to non-harm. Not as some kind of moral statement, because that's what it sees. The reason we embody selfishness is because that's what we see. Separate things and my need to protect my property from you. That's why we do it. Change the perception, which is what we'll get into as we move down the Eightfold Path. Change that perception, which is possible. In the seen, there is just what is seen. And the accompanying action, wise action, doesn't hold the selfishness, the tinge of self-protection or defensiveness that the idea of self held. It's not something magic. It's something seen. I'm trying to get you to see a different way. Someone said, I can't remember, it's something like, it's the spiritual liberation is not in finding, discovering new landscapes, having new ideas, but having new eyes. This is an immediate perception. And when you see only what is seen, that is equivalent to seeing in unison. To seeing all together. And when you see in unison, see things all together, then the heart does not separate any aspect of what it sees from one another, from itself, or from anything else. And so the actions then come from the affection that is that seeing. I'm trying to point towards a very subtle dharma in words that feel very gross to me. But I don't know how to walk. Instead of like an elephant, I need to walk like a mosquito into this dharma. Like the legs, the footfalls need to be so because that's what we're talking about really. Both that degree of tenderness, but also that degree of subtlety. This is it. Just this. How could it be anything else? What else is there, you see? I mean, just logically you can see it. Just logically, if you get the frame of reference, you see, that there couldn't possibly be anything else because reality only has one perception. It's not as if it could be any other way. The only way it can be some other way is for us to think that it's some other way. And the moment you start thinking that it's some other way, you're not seeing that the thought is arising within the same way. And therefore, the thought, because it's not seeing, takes us away, we embody the words. We go into the words, and the words hold time. Every word holds time, holds meaning. And therefore, we move out with the word as if there was another reality other than the one that is directly perceivable. And at some point, the mind catches on to that just through awareness, because awareness has the ability to also see that it's thinking. And when it sees that it's thinking, it's not embedded in the thought anymore, and therefore is not traveling with the thought. And therefore it is stopped, and it's only the thought that's moving. And when we realize that only the thought is moving, that nothing else is moving, then we just release the need to have to be identified with the thought. And everything comes to a stop. And everything continues to move. Both of those are true. But the real reality, the truth, the absolute truth is in the stopping. But the mind keeps going. It just keeps going because it only knows to keep going. It's like a radio that you can't unplug. It just keeps chattering, and that's it. It'll do that if you're waiting for it not to do that. But it quiets down a great deal. Yes.
I really enjoyed this talk tonight. It reminded me a lot of when I was entering my teen years and through my teenage years when I was dealing with a lot of philosophy, and you put so many words to things I thought at that time. And how it was almost simple at that time to just stop time while I was thinking about these things. It wasn't like I went future. I realized something and I just sat in the realization of it.
Yes.
And then just sitting here thinking about it, I was thinking, well, maybe I should ask Rodney how I can get back to that. And I realized, of course I can have it. I just have to. So here I am.
Beautiful. That's it. Okay, now that's a tremendous key. She said she was going to ask me how to get back to it, but realized that of course she could get back to it because she's in it. That's a tremendous thing, because then every thought that seems to take you away, like, oh, this, nothing's happening here, I'm not progressing, that thought becomes a cue for you to shut up. Because it's the wrong way. It's telling you something that's taking you into a kind of perpetuation of referencing, right? So you get onto that. And so in the deepest despair, you add nothing. And despair cannot continue. In the deepest sense of self-doubt, we add nothing. And the doubt cannot continue. In the deepest sense of trouble, deeply disturbed, troubledness, where I get up and it feels like everything is dead, nothing has any aliveness, where is my practice? In that moment, it is a cue to shut up. Not a cue to go find your cushion. Do you see? Because then you challenge the very things, the very ways that we have been prone and conditioned to keep the misery moving, or delaying the misery, or pursuing the other side of the misery, to get over the misery, to wade ourselves through the misery. We apply the Buddha's teaching in terms of time, and it becomes a wreck.
Well, it's almost as if the minute I try to put a word to it, I've lost it.
Exactly, yes.
I have to just leave it there. And the minute I engage language, I've already...
Right.
I've already
gone. Okay, so you're seeing something. Okay, so now start applying it to your story, which is huge. Right? Right, so now the story can't take you anywhere. It can't take you to the tragedy of your life. It can't take you to your self-pity. You see how strong you have to be? You have to be willing to give up your emotional scarring and say, this means nothing. All of my past, as treacherous and abusive as it has been, means nothing. Or, I'm so identified with milking this story, this reference of myself as being the tragic figure of abuse, I can't give it up, and I'm going to have to go to therapy for the rest of my life. Those are the alternatives. I don't know. Giving it up, what does it mean? What does it mean to give it up? It means giving up the faults, because it's not true. If it were true, be miserable. You have the perfect right to be miserable. But you don't have any right to be miserable. You have no right to be miserable. Not in truth. Not in truth. Now, I told you we were going to take a ride out into the bus load, and we're bus loading it. We're going out there now a little bit. Not a little bit, a lot. And then everything, because everything we have made our lives to be about has to do with the misery and our identification with the struggle. To give up the struggle means we have to, there's a complete disorientation. A complete bewilderment. And now, and we don't know what to do. There's no immediate project at hand. Because most of what I've done in my life is trying to solve my struggle. So that's been my project. But if the struggle stops because I refuse to perpetuate it, what am I going to do? See, that's the first awkwardness of awakening. Now what? I'll wait till we all get there before I answer that one. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Sometimes I wonder if you do actually lean into the other person, but you're aware, then you notice that it's moving.
The question is, if you lean into the other person and you're aware of it, does that necessarily correct? Does the awareness necessarily correct it?
Well, I think you almost go the other way. You do.
Yes.
What you've done badly, even worse. And
then okay, so that's a possibility too. See. There can be a backlash. If it stays in the mind, which mostly it does, then you're going to have a backlash. When you see yourself leaning too much, you're going to go the other way, an equal and opposite direction. And you're going to try to become self-reliant and independent, and it's going to be a reaction against what you've seen. And so when that happens, you know that you aren't free of the story, you're reacting to the story. Okay? Because the story doesn't leave anybody out of your heart. And if you're moving, taking yourself and turning your back on someone, you're leaving them out of your heart. And the story, and the heart never does that. And so when you see something genuinely, and so that you can really let it go, letting it go, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, not letting it go in some kind of relative way, then the caring remains. You don't lose the caring in the relationship. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you all very much.